Don't waste any more time. Please welcome Mary Jane.
Breathe. Thank you, Katie. Thank you for hosting me, and thank you for that kind of introduction. I'm a good eater. I want to thank Eric and the whole committee. Thank you kindly. This has been a wonderful, wonderful weekend. Truly, good spirit here. And it's true, each of these events does take on a life of its own. And I knew a guy one time who said that a group gets the speaker it deserves, so be very careful. No, but really, you all have made this environment, and I'm grateful to get to share in it, because I never realize until it's almost too late how much I need to be fed, and I've certainly been fed this weekend, and I appreciate that. And John and Kathy, thank you so much. Thanks for, you know. I know why I was on the list. And Philip, who contacted me first, and Drew, who contributed so much. I've thoroughly enjoyed all of the historical stuff that you guys have here. It's a treasure, and I really appreciate that so much. Jerry and Maggie and Mike and Kathy, that the tapers have added so much to my whole sobriety, and not any less than this weekend. It's been wonderful. So I really am glad to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity. I am an alcoholic. My name is Mary Jane.
Hi.
And let's see, I never know how to get started, but I grew up in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, and if you want to make a limerick about that, you feel free, you know. There was a young girl from Pawtucket who carried, you know. I grew up in the prerequisite alcoholic home. My maiden name was O'Connor, so I'm here honestly. You know, just your regulation alcoholic, I guess. A regular kid. I didn't start to get into any real trouble until I was into college. All of the early drinking I did was pretty penny ante. I worked at, if you've ever heard of Block Island, it's a resort community, and I worked there summers. And that's where I really got off to a good start. But by college is where it began to show up that I drank differently. And I knew it was different. Actually, I was so proud of it because I drank a lot. And, you know, and I used to actually say things like, you know, some people really shouldn't drink. You know, if anybody else wasn't doing as good a job as I was, I wanted to make sure that people would recognize my skills. Until junior year, and that was when I got called in and told I could leave. I kind of saw it coming. I didn't even buy any books that semester. There was another girl in my class, and she actually wanted to be an airline stewardess. And so she was leaving voluntarily. She just wanted to get out, finish with school and get on with her life. And she asked if I would ride to Providence with her on the bus, and I said, sure, I didn't have anything else to do. So while I was there, I filled out an application, and I got hired. I'd never been on a plane, but I didn't have anything else to do, so I went off to the training school for Eastern Airlines. Yes, they are defunct, and no, it's not my fault. I loved it. I loved it. It was a really great life. It was just a party. I you know, that's the way I saw it, and therein lies the problem, you know. So this is where it really began to show, the effects were beginning to show up. I was sick a lot. I mean, I was really sick. Because I wanted to get there. I wanted to go on the flights and stuff, but I couldn't move. And by then I was getting into a lot of car accidents and stuff like that. So it was a good idea when I didn't go. But I used people a lot to cover up for me. And pretty soon the being late turned into I actually missed trips. And I got to tell you, that's a big deal with the airline. You know, if you're late for your work and it's in an office building, you know there's a back door and a side door, and you can come in and take your coat off so as you look like you've been there for a while and all that. If your job is a flight and you get to the airport 30 minutes after, it's gone. And everybody noticed. Because they have to have a set number of people who comprise the crew members. So they've taken somebody off some other flight who didn't know they were going to Houston that day. And it just is a big upheaval. So then I started getting called in, and I started getting all these certified letters. And I thought that was inconvenient. If you get a certified letter, you have to go to the post office and you sign for stuff, and then it tells you when you got to go in and appear and all this other business. But that's the truth. I really was annoyed by the whole thing, and that tells you how far from reality I really was. I didn't get it. I just didn't see. Never occurred to me how much I had not only inconvenienced the airline, but I was really a screw-up by then. And just, I was more trouble than I was worth. And I was starting to know that, you know. Well, it went on. I worked for Eastern for 6 years. And because I told them, you know, I really did a good job when I got there. And so, anyway, but finally, I was on probation, I was on all kinds of other stuff, but they finally canned me, and I was shocked. So I got fired, and pretty soon I got another job. I got a job with an incredible company that only hired women, and it was a sales and service kind of deal with an international company, and they gave me 5 states that I was supposed to cover and a brand new Oldsmobile. And yeah, I know, I wrecked it too. But I always had a really good story for what had happened, and I actually had it somewhere in my head that that's all I owed anybody, was a really good story about what happened. And whenever anything happens, the first thing my go-to is think up a really, really interesting lie. And that's what I did. I lied a lot. So the last 3 years of my active alcoholism were in Annapolis, Maryland, and that was the center of this 5-state territory that I was supposed to be calling on hospitals and doctors, and I was supposed to be covering this whole territory for this really good company. And I found an apartment, and it was nice, but I turned it into kind of a cave over a period of time. You know, the shades all drawn, and that's where my life absolutely fell apart. Up until then, I didn't drink every day, and I didn't always get drunk. Of course, I never knew when I was going to get drunk. But no matter what I said in the morning, like I would say things like, you're really doing a terrible job on your innards. You should really just cool it for today. Okay, that's a good idea. And sometimes I'd get all the way through lunch, and without drinking, although John and I were talking, I didn't count beer, and I didn't, or wine, You know, those were beverages. Beer you have with a sandwich, right? That's not drinking, you know. So anyways, with my own rules, I was able to get through some days. But always, by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I would start to get itchy. And then the argument would start in my head about, well, you know, it's not like I'm not going to drink again someday, so why am I going through this agony, you know? Let's just pull over and get a bottle, you know? And no matter what, by the end of the day, I had a glass in my hand. And I would have told you that I changed my mind. But see, that's alcoholism. I didn't change my mind. I think if all I told you was that I drank a lot when I didn't want to, that's probably enough. That's probably all I need to qualify around here. I drank when I didn't even want to. Who could understand that except a room full of you guys, you know? And thanks for that. But it got worse. And the only thing that saved me with that company for as long as it did was that the home office was in Chicago, and I told you I was in Annapolis, Maryland. And by then, physically, I was really kind of bummed out. I was burned out. Part of my territory was on the other side of the Bay Bridge, but I couldn't drive over bridges. My nervous system was just shot. So if I had to go to the eastern shore of Maryland, I had to drive inland all the way up and around. And that was just more than I could face sometimes, you know. So all in all, it was falling apart. It was just unraveling all over the place. And I was in a deep, deep black depression. When I was in the apartment, I was almost immobilized, and I would just kind of get up off the couch and get another drink and go into the bedroom, and then I would get up off the bed and go into the kitchen and lie on the couch, and I would drink and cry and pass out, and it was so sad. Oh, I was talking to the Sinatras. One of my best things was sad music. And I would play Frank Sinatra's Only the Lonely, which is, it's music to slit your wrists by. And I would hear this pathetic moaning, and it was me. But it was so sad. And just drink and cry and pass out and drink and cry and pass out and do the same thing again the next day. And it had actually deteriorated to that. There wasn't any real bust up with my family. I was just kind of not alienated, but separated from them because they didn't pay any attention to me. You don't have a conversation with somebody that you can't believe. And so if I ever said I was coming home, I wasn't coming. And they knew that. Nobody took anything out of the freezer. I just wasn't going to get there. So I wasn't talking to hardly anybody. Most of the people that I would have said were my old friends were unraveling too, you know, and they were busy. So anyway, it was just downhill. It really sincerely was. Now, the funny thing was, my dad had gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 12 years old. So way in the back of my head, I knew that if you had a problem with drinking, if you went to AA, you could get help and it would change your life. I knew that. I didn't think about it a whole lot, but it was in there. And it didn't seem as though that information was all that useful to me because I wasn't an alcoholic. I was sure I knew what an alcoholic was, and I would tell people what an alcoholic was because of my dad, you know, and because I knew everything anyhow. But in my conscious mind, I was certain I was not an alcoholic. I never let that consideration remain very long to think about. And then one day I got up off the couch, I walked past the kitchen, and I went into the bedroom, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I swear to you, it's the first conscious thought that I'd ever had that maybe that had something to do with the way I was living. And that's very strange. That's really strange. And how come I did that? But I called AA, and I didn't want them to think I needed to, so I said something like, when would you have a meeting in the Eastport area, you know, because I knew everything. And I knew what a pigeon was, you know, I knew a lot of stuff. But they gave me directions. They said there was a men's stag that night. This was in September or October of 67, because I got started then. I lost about a month in there somewhere, so it's around in there. But but the following night there was a meeting, and it was as far away from the front door of that apartment as that exit sign. It was a church right across the street, and I did. They told me not to drink, but to get to that meeting the following day. And you know what? I didn't drink. I didn't drink. And that night, I went and I got in my car, and I drove around, and then pulled up. I don't know what I was doing. I don't understand it, but that I'm just reporting. That's what I did. And so I went to the meeting, and here's all I know. I've heard people say all the wonderful things they heard at their first meeting. I don't know. But the people were nice to me. And I'll never, ever forget that. I can still see their faces, and I can remember a lot of their names. They were just really nice to me. And I went home, and I felt different. And they had told me about some other meetings that there were, and there weren't a whole lot in Annapolis. Now they've got a whole intergroup. You know, they got morning, noon, and night, and every kind of description of meetings that you could imagine. Well, it wasn't that way then. But that was good news and bad news, because the good news was they would, on the off nights when there wasn't a meeting, you'd gather down at the tire store, and they'd carpool and go to a meeting in the next town. And that was very valuable, too. That was a wonderful thing to get to do. And you really do get to meet people that way and know people and connect. And it was a good time. Pretty soon, I was actually functioning at work. But it was a little too little too late, but I knew I was going to get fired. So but I was hanging in, and I was actually making a living. I was actually showing up. I was doing what I was supposed to be doing, and it was a whole new world. And then I here's what I do when the heat's off. I get cocky. So I was kind of flitting in and out of AA meetings. I was getting there late, and I was saying snotty things about some of the other people, and, you know, their grammar wasn't up to my standards and things like that. You know, what the heck, what is that all about? But that's how I was acting. And I started to get a little concerned. So I heard, some of us who were, you know, we just thought we were so adorable and wonderful. There were about five of us who were younger than most everybody else. And we knew that those old burnouts didn't know what they were talking about. So when, you know, they would say things like, it's the first drink that gets you drunk, which is really important information. But you know, we just would make fun of all of that stuff. And we would get together in a bar, of course, after the meetings, and drink Cokes and be wonderful and bright and funny and all that stuff. And but it anyway, we started this young adults group, not young people's. We invented young adults. I really thought we had. And then we got these flyers from the Young People's International, which was going to be held that year in Toronto, Canada, in August of 1968. And I thought, I need to do that. I need to do something really special and big and important to see if I can get a better grasp here. And so I started to plan to go, and a lot of people were going, but as it got closer to the time, they all peeled off. So I got in my car, and I drove 3 days from Annapolis to Toronto. It shouldn't take you that long, but I don't know why. I don't know what I was doing. But anyways, I was having a really great experience, so I'll tell you that. I really was. I was having an experience with... I heard a lady talk one time in at Laity Lodge in Texas, and her name was Gert Behana, and she said that her alcoholism was a lot like being a Siamese twin, that one had to die that the other could live. And that's the kind of experience I had. It was as though my old life was really falling away from me. I knew who that person was, but it didn't hurt anymore. And it was quite an experience. And then I got to Toronto, and I got to the Royal York Hotel, and it was beautiful. And these people were coming from all over the United States and Canada, and their lives were not over, and they were very attractive. They made AA look good. I really wanted to connect here. It looked very important and good to me. And so that weekend, I found the person who had sent those flyers to my home group, because there had been a note that said, on to Toronto, Don R. So I found this Don R, who was one of the speakers, and I went up to him and I said, "You're the reason I'm here." And we got married 3 weeks later. So what? Vinoy was faster. So anyhow, that's not the funny part. This is my only funny story. But here's the thing: I was living in Annapolis, and I had a wonderful, wonderful sponsor there. When I got drunk ultimately in Annapolis and came back, and when I came back, I did get a sponsor. And this was Mac, and he was a retired Navy captain, and he was a fine man, and he really brought some order to my life. He brought some sanity that I needed real bad. Anyway, by then I had a sponsor, and I had a home group there and all. So I told Don he would have to come to Annapolis and meet Mac. Poor Mac. Anyway, Don came to Annapolis, and then he went on to where he lived in Denver, and I finished my working for that whole month, and then I was to fly to Denver for our wedding. And I think this is funny. On the plane, I was thinking, God, I hope I recognize him when I get off the plane. So I did, and this was in August of 1968, and he had co-chaired the Young People's International the year before, and you know, we're still in touch with, I still am in touch. Don passed away in 1995, but we'd already been divorced by then, so, well, that's down the road. Anyhow, but we were married for 10 years, and we have a son, and stepchildren, as I have stepchildren as well, and I can't complain. I can't, Don opened up the world for me. But the first next mistake that I made was that I went around being Mrs. Don for a while. You know, I just kind of walked respectfully behind him. And if he thought it was a good meeting, I thought it was a good meeting. And no matter what Don said, I was Mrs. Don. That's all I needed to be, and I got plenty of recognition for that, and that was okay with me. Nobody made me do that. I just did it. And it was a mistake. Because I almost let go of the little bit of recovery that I had. It could have been serious. But I think I've made a lot of mistakes, but that's all they are, is mistakes. And you don't have, if you don't defend it, you can get through it. And that's, I've been making a lot of them ever since, and trying hard not to defend it. But At any rate, we were part of the old Denver Young People's Group, and thank God for that, because they knew what they were doing. Don P. And a whole bunch of just extraordinary people. And it was an extraordinary time. You know that of that ragtag bunch, there's still about 30 of us who are roughly still in touch and still sober. And out of that funky old group, there were at least two trustees, a number of delegates, serious committed members of Alcoholics Anonymous, but still sober after 40-some years, can you believe? And it was an amazing group, an amazing outfit. And because we just, when we came to something that said this is what you're supposed to do, we did it. If it said don't do that, we quit doing it. But we didn't know any better. And we hung together, and we took a meeting down to Canyon City every month, to the prison, and we got the hang of so much of the stuff that's important for us to do, about carrying the message and being there for people. And anyway, it was a good thing, and I'm grateful for them. I'm still grateful for them today. What I was doing while I was sitting here and listening to Joe, and I appreciate that, Joe. Thank you a lot. But I was feeling waves but washing over me of the people who are really responsible for my coming here today. The people who hand-carried me through so much early on. I never was allowed to get very far off in the weeds, you know. There were wonderful, wonderful people who took very good care of me. And I was just feeling that. The next thing that happened was that Don was feeling, I didn't realize how seriously he was concerned for his own sobriety, but he decided that we were going to move to Texas to a pocket of enthusiasm at Lake Whitney, Texas. And that would, he never let me know that he needed to go there. And so we packed up and moved to Lake Whitney, Texas. And I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for every minute of it. We lived there for about 5 years, and it was indeed a pocket of enthusiasm. It was enthusiastic Alcoholics Anonymous. It was every good story you ever heard about the early times. It was like that. It really was. And we went to conferences, and then Don's ex-wife died, and we inherited his children. And boy, you know, I was more immature than they were, so I really needed help really bad, really bad. And I went to Bob W., who was our honcho guru and bigger than life guy, and I went to him and I told him that I was in bad shape, that I really wasn't. I was in worse shape than he could imagine, and he said, "Well, you need to talk to my wife." And I thought, are you crazy? She's an Al-Anon, for God's sakes. I got trouble. And that was Marcy W., and that's who took me through the steps and absolutely hand-carried me for about 10 years and taught me. Anyway, but Don did drink again, and fortunately, I was connected by then, and I was actively involved in my own recovery again, and it was great. There was a place that we had heard of in upstate New York where there was a recovery community, and they were very, very, very ferocious, and I thought, Don needs to go there. He wasn't ready to cash in, so I called them up and asked them if I could come. And by then I had not had a drink in a couple of years, and they said, "Yes, you can come if you're willing to sign on for the basic stay, which was 2 months." And I said, "Okay, I'll come," because I was crazy as a loon. And so I went up there, and it was the Eastridge community up in the Catskill Mountains of New York. And it had been started by Tom P., who was the editor of the 12 and 12 and a close personal friend of Bill W.'s. But it was weird. like you were up at 5 in the morning so that you could chant from the Psalms, and then you could go run and then eat your comfrey leaves and scrape paint and peel carrots. And you were off sugar, coffee. You were off everything that you ever wanted to do. It was all... From the minute you got there, all at once, and you might as well, because you're just going to feel awful anyhow. So anyway, but it was ferocious. It really, really was. There were truth groups and all kinds of stuff. But as soon as anybody took their eyes off of me, if I had any excuse to go into town for any errands or anything, I would go fish through butts outside of the stores and everything, and sneak smokes. And then I would get to the truth group, and I always, then I smoked again, you know. Oh, geez, you know. So anyways, but here's how they would help you. They said that it was a good idea for us to examine our shortcomings and get to the exact nature of our wrongs. And then we had to make a sign that would describe what was the problem underlying. And we had to make up the sign and then bring it to our house sponsor. So I wrote what I figured out about me, and it was, I am sneaky and defiant. And that about sums it up, and it's the truth. So I made my little sign, and then you have to wear it around your neck. Which is okay when you're just in the house with all the other inmates. But but if the doorbell rings and it's the UPS guy or something, you have to stand there with a big sign around your neck saying, I am sneaky and defiant. You know? So anyway, but it does, it gets to you at a level underneath, you know, it's good. There was one girl who kept gossiping, and she had to, her sign was, don't turn your back on me, and stuff like that. But it was good, it was good. But I want to say something about them only because they helped me an enormous amount. It was the beginning of a meaningful prayer life for me, a significant prayer life. I'm into repetitive prayer where I tune it to my breathing, and when I'm not doing anything in particular, the prayer starts up. And the one that worked for me, there are any numbers of these kind of repetitive prayers that people use. Mine has always been, Thy kingdom come, Thy will be done, on the out-breath. And it's helped me with depression, it's helped me with panic, it's helped me with a lot of stuff. And now, you know, the more often you go through the book, the more often you see some stuff that's always been there, you know. But the one of the newest things that I found was, we say very often, or we say over and over, Thy will be done is throughout our book, over and over. I didn't even know I was in compliance. But so many things have just been given me. They just came. I was going to tell you about Mac when Mac brought me through the first three steps, but then Marceline did a lot of the heavy lifting. And then when I got up to Eastridge, I had to do another inventory and another fifth step. And they pointed out to me that there was no fourth column in my inventory. Well, yeah, so... And, you know, I was on a different page, for crying out loud. So, but that was a big thing. That was another big hurdle to get through. The fourth column of our inventory is the other thing that really changed my life drastically, dramatically, when it wasn't them anymore. It's not them. I got to come to terms with, I either started it, or I participated in it, or whatever. And I can trace everything in my resentment and fear and sex inventory to something that I did. But coming to that has been life-changing for me. To begin to take responsibility and to start to grow up, for goodness sake. AA is my value system. It's central to my life. It's not just a part, you know. It's like my values, you know. If I didn't get caught at something, that was okay with me. It was like it never happened. And that's not much of a value system. Now I really know that I absolutely have to own and take care of and clean up and fess up and say who I am and what I do, be where I said I'd be responsible. Anyway, these things are, it's been gradual, but fortunately, and this is overwhelming to me too, to think that I've been an Alcoholics Anonymous, sober, responsible member for 46 years, because I never stayed with anything. I had a lot of cards in my wallet of organizations that I belonged to, but I always said they. Because it was they. I wasn't really a part of anything, but I'm genuinely a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a member of AA, and I'm grateful for that. Eventually, Don and I split. He wanted to move again and go back and start his business up in Nashville, and I just said, I'm done. And we'd been married then for about 10 years, and I went back to school. And I'm grateful I got to do that, because I went into a physician assistant program, and it was sort of like I got put on track, you know, after getting kicked out of college. Now I was getting another chance, and it was a big deal for me, and it was important. And by then we had our son Brian, and so Brian and I went off to Pennsylvania for 2 years to college. And I was 20 years older than the next person in my class. And I was telling somebody the other day that we were talking about being special and all that. And they gave me a special award at graduation. Nobody said what it was for. But I'll tell you what it was for. It was for AA. Because that's my thinking today. And I use really good AA thinking a lot of times. And they knew, they recognized that there was something different about me, and there is, because of AA. So anyhow, I got this work. Anyway, I went to work, and I got a job in Illinois, and I worked out there for 5 years. And then one day, a communication came through saying that there was an opening in Providence, Rhode Island, for exactly my job description, the whole thing. And I thought, that's my job, and it's time to go home. And this was in 1985, and that's when I moved back to Rhode Island. And I'm thrilled to death that I got to do that, because one of the biggest things that happened was that when I moved back to Rhode Island, I knew enough that I had to absolutely fight my way into comfort. I had to make myself care about the people there and not make fun of them for the way they talked and stuff like that. And it, you know, wherever you move, they do it wrong. And they don't care how AA was done where you came from. Anyway, but it was new and a new opportunity for me. And I finally, I shopped around and I went to plenty of meetings and groups, and I finally found a new home group. And I was at the business meeting, and I would not belong to a group that doesn't have a business meeting. So I was at the business meeting, and some lady came and said that she was the district committee member for District 7, which is where I lived. I didn't know it was District 7. I didn't know anything about the service structure, and I was about 18 years sober. But I'd always lived way out in the country. I'd lived in small places, and besides that, I just asked Don a lot, you know. But I didn't get the hang of it. I just assumed that there was a meeting where they said there was going to be a meeting, and somebody had done some work. But well, thanks a lot. I didn't get it. You know, I just really didn't get it. So she said that group did not have a general service representative, and so it wasn't connected to big AA, all of AA. And she said, we're making decisions for you, for this group. And I thought, I'll be darned. And it was intriguing to me. So I started asking around and getting some information about this GSR thing and this DCM thing. And I campaigned shamelessly, and I got elected. Because they thought, if you've been sober for all that long time, you know what you're doing. So it wasn't true. But anyways, but if I were to give any advice, I rarely do, truthfully. But I would say that if you haven't, and I don't think there's much of that going on around here, but if you're not really involved in the general service structure, don't wait till you know what it's all about. Just go ahead and say, yeah, I could do that, or I'm willing. And you'll figure it out, and it'll all begin to make sense when you're actually doing it. I think of it like Clancy's invisible boat. When you start to row, you can see the boat. But you got to be rowing. And if you quit rowing, the boat goes away. But anyways, I think that you have to really, it's the action. You don't have to know which is tradition 6 or concept 4. You get the hang of it, and you get the rhythm of it, and you get to begin to understand why, and to be in awe of what we have here. And I really am, and I think that's probably why I appreciate so much the stories and the timeline here. This is magnificent. I was just enthralled by that. But about learning about the early guys and their stories and all of it, I'm big into the whole historical thing at this point. Now, then I got to do cooperation with the professional community because, you know, in the course of my work, I came upon a lot of alcoholics, and I wanted to be sure that if an alcoholic made an appointment with his doctor, that doctor would have had some contact with us. The whole thing was starting to make sense to me. I did some other stuff in the area, and then I stood for delegate, and I got elected. And I was panel 42, which means that would have been in 1992. And you serve as the delegate for 2 years. So I became a member of the General Service Conference. And my own state, my own area's delegate for 2 years. And it was overwhelming. But, you know, one of those old Denver young people by now had become a trustee, and I called him up and I said, would you be my service sponsor? Will you help me with this, because I don't get the hang of it? And he said, yes, first read AA Comes of Age, and I did. And he told me some other stuff to do, and I did it. And it was really, really, really helpful, and I had somebody that I could talk to, and it was wonderful. I loved it, and it was hard, but I still loved it. In Rhode Island, after you serve as the delegate, you automatically become state convention chair. And so I did that for 2 years. And then after that, I stood for trustee of the Northeast region. And I got elected to that. And I got to serve on AA's General Service Board for 4 years as a non-alcoholic Class B trustee. And I cannot, words absolutely fail me. That's the best time I ever had in my whole life. I loved it. It was so exciting and great because I really felt like I was doing something worthwhile. And I would have done anything, you know, even if it hadn't been so much fun, but I loved it, loved it, loved it. And I was inspired by the people that I got to hang out with and do business with under those circumstances. I served with a guy who was a bishop, a guy who was a warden, a PhD social worker, and this was a woman, a family court judge. Some were Class B. It's easy to remember. B are the boozers. Class A are the amateurs. So there are 7 non-alcoholic and 14 alcoholic trustees on our 21-member General Service Board. So some of these were alcoholics, some were non-alcoholics, and you know what? Most of the time you couldn't tell the difference in a meeting. I'm telling you. One time we had this horrific, it was a trustees dinner, but it got awful. It got terrible, and there was shouting, and we kept calling it the food fight. And there was a new person on board, and this was the bishop, and I was thinking, oh, we'll never see him again. He came down the next morning all bright and ready to go again, and I said, I got to tell you the truth, Bob, I didn't think you'd be back. He said, oh, that was just like the House of Bishops. So, but it was wonderful, wonderful, and I'm thrilled to death that I got to do that. And I sure encourage everybody to get involved actively. I think that it's the bonus round when you begin to participate as an active, involved person in the general service structure and do all that you can for the well-being of Alcoholics Anonymous and the preservation. You're not going to change much. That's good. And everything could be changed, essentially. Even the traditions. Everything could be changed, but it's not easy, and that's the good part. You know, if it absolutely needs to be changed, we could do it, but it would require a substantial unanimity and two-thirds of everybody in the known AA world, you know, and so that's how it ought to be, I believe, so that we keep the treasure that we have, which has sustained us for these 79 years, and it's magnificent. Anyway, what do I do now? I get up in the morning and I say my prayers. I try and tell the truth. I don't always tell the truth, but I was such a liar, for God's sake. It's incredible how far I've come. I would lie and I would run. I would just run away. If something was hard for me to deal with, I would leave. I would split. I was out the back door, the side door. I never told people I was leaving. I just left. I didn't show up. And I drank. And now I hardly lie and I don't run. And I don't drink. And I have a sponsor. I sponsor women, and I'm grateful for it. They're the richness of my life. I do commitments. We take an AA meeting into a detox. And I also go to the women's prison once a month. I drove drunk all the time. And that's what an awful lot of those women did too. And so I want to make sure that there's an AA meeting in the jail for them to go to. And we make it something that we all look forward to. We meet at Whole Foods. There's about four or five of us, and we have a lovely dinner together. We break bread, whole grain, no gluten, but we really look forward to it, and we call it Slammer Day. And when we call each other on that day to see who's coming that week, they'll say, Happy Slammer Day! But we've made it something that we really enjoy and feel so excited about doing. And I hope that shows to the women when we take that meeting into the prison, is that their lives don't have to be over with either, that there's something that they can... There's a life beyond belief available to them. And that there is a solution. I love your theme, because there is a solution. And it's available to anybody who walks in the door. The steps don't know who's taking them. If you follow the directions, you can have recovery here. You honest to God can. And begin to live a life that you can feel proud of. And I don't think pride in that in that department is a bad thing. I feel proud of the life that I lead today. I'm not afraid of being discovered. It's okay. So Alcoholics Anonymous has been central to my life these 46 years, and I'm just overwhelmingly grateful for the opportunity to hopefully to pass some of that along and share and just celebrate with you guys. I thank you from the bottom of my heart, and thanks for your attention.